I'd like to call this meeting of the House State Affairs Committee to order. The time is 3:16 on Thursday, March 5th, 2026, and we are here in room 120. Please silence cell phones today. Representatives present include Representative St. Clair, Representative Holland, Vice Chair Story, and myself, Chair Carrick. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Our record secretary is Lori Rowland, and our moderator from the Juno LAO is Renzo Moises. And our committee aide for today's hearing is my staff, Stuart Relay. On today's agenda, we have three items. We're taking up House Bill 250 from Representative Hannon, followed by House Bill 152 from Representative Galvin, and finishing today, as time allows, with House Bill 278 from Representative Costello. The first item on today's agenda is House Bill 250 on peace officer face masks from Representative Hannon. This is our fourth hearing on the bill. At our hearing on Tuesday, I set an amendment deadline for Wednesday, March 4th at 5 p.m. We did receive six amendments. Today, we're going to consider amendments and look to the will of the committee. For members' information, we did have a request from Representative McCabe at our last hearing to have the Department of Law available for questions, and we did ask them to be available. Yesterday, our office was informed that they're not available for this hearing, but they are happy to respond to committee members in writing after the hearing. So accordingly, if there are additional questions for the Department of Law specifically, please feel free to either send them to the DOL directly or to forward them to my office. Additionally, our committee is again joined by Sarah Heap from the Alaska Police Standards Council for any questions that may be relevant to them. And before we begin our amendment process, I'd like to recognize Representative Himshut has joined us. And I'd like to welcome Representative Hannon and her staff to the table and allow them to join us here. If you have any opening remarks before we get started, please feel free to put yourself on the record and offer those.
Representative Sarah Hannon, House District 4, sponsor of House Bill 250. You were recently here. I don't think I need to refresh your memories of what the bill is about, so I'll just allow you to take up your busy committee schedule with items before you.
Thank you, Representative Hannon. And so let's go ahead and jump into the amendment process. And the first amendment is from my office in collaboration with the bill sponsor's office. And I'm going to move Amendment 1, also known as I.5. And I'll object for discussion just to make sure we put on the record what it is. So Amendment Number 1, also known as I.5, is again, drafted in consultation with the sponsor's office and in response to communications between the sponsor's office and the Department of Public Safety. Broadly speaking, it provides law enforcement officers more flexibility to safely conduct their work without being impacted, with additional exemptions addressing Alaskan-centric issues. Essentially, it continues the effort to identify a balance between those concerned with masked peace officers and those officers' ability to safely do their job. And specifically on page 1, lines 6 through 11, it replaces existing bill language related to medical mask usage with clearer and more applicable language. The new language specifies that a mask can include medical or surgical masks designed to protect against transmission of disease or infection, and also includes air purifying respirators, self-contained breathing apparatuses for smoke, gas, or other harmful environmental conditions. Further on page 1, lines 15 through 17, this amendment provides an exception for helmet usage while using a motorcycle, snow machine, ATV, or any other vehicle that requires a helmet for safe usage. On page 1, line 18 through page 2, line 3, it provides a further exemption for when a peace officer is part of a tactical operation requiring protective gear for immediate safety, and also defines a tactical operation. And finally, it provides an exemption for a peace officer who is assigned to a special weapons and tactics team that is actively performing the duties of that team. And that's on page 2, lines 4 and 5. Before committee discussion, I would, and before we turn it over to additional discussion here. Representative Hannon, do you have any additional comment on this amendment?
I would urge your adoption of this amendment, again, in an attempt to reflect the functioning reality of Alaskan peace officers. We want to make sure it's clear that we want safety gear when safety is necessary, helmets, exemptions for, you know, SWAT team tactical response gear, things that we want to make sure they're not mistaken for the prohibition of masking for identity, but that our peace officers always have the appropriate condition allowances.
Thank you for that, Representative Hannon. I'll also just note for the record that at 3:18 approximately, Representative Vance also joined us. And is there any committee discussion on this amendment? Representative St. Clair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I like this. It narrows the scope. However, I do not think it does what the author intends to do. Thank you.
Okay. Noted.
I'll expound later.
Okay. I wanted to put this language forward personally because I do think it helps to more narrowly tailor where this bill is applicable and where it's not applicable and apply to some of the Alaska conditions that may not exist in other states, but definitely exist here. I'm going to remove my objection to amendment number one. Is there additional objection? Seeing none, amendment number one, also known as I.5, has been adopted. As we continue to offer amendments, I would just encourage members to try to refer to an amendment both by its number and by its I dot number, just for clarity. And at this time, I'll turn to Representative St. Clair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment number two, I.9.
And I object. Representative St. Clair.
The intent of this is to give parity. Anyone interacting with a peace officer cannot disguise or cover their face either. That's basically it.
Okay. And what we will also do is I will just look to see if the sponsor has any comment as we go through each amendment, and then we'll go to additional discussion. So, Representative Hannon.
Madam Chair, I would oppose this amendment, and I think it conflates government agents working on behalf of the government with public citizen and actions. There are certainly times where citizens have the right to anonymity, and there are times when citizens have an obligation to identify themselves, but those are very different than the obligations of peace officers acting as government agents. So I would view this as making the issues conflated when they should not be.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hannon. Additional committee discussion. I will also offer wrap up each time too. Representative Vance and then Holland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I support this amendment because it says while interacting with the peace officer. That's specific language. And many of the reasons that the sponsor identified for the reason that peace officers should not be having a mask when interacting with the public is that it creates a barrier to communication. And in an attempt to de-escalate, and the peace officer trying to assess the situation is also going to be in that position trying to assess with someone's mask covered, of trying to figure out, read their verbal expressions and things like that, and the level of de-escalation that they need to interact with, and being able to properly hear the interaction. And so I think this is a reasonable amendment in just saying, hey, if there's going to be a true interaction, then they need to be openly and clearly communicating.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Representative Holland.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. I
I don't support the amendment. I am trying to figure out how to articulate something in terms of my position on this, because I am truly and deeply concerned about the masking of officers to the degree that they are trying to create anonymity and, I think, trying to increase intimidation. And, you know, when it comes to some sort of fairness or something, you know, these officers already, you know, have the power and stature of uniforms. They're frequently carrying some sort of tools, arms, shields. It's not a fair comparison to say that we need to have, you know, both unmasked in order to level the playing field. There's nothing level at all about the power and impact of having a group of officers confronting citizens. And the ability at the end of the day, in many different respects of our Constitution, both our federal and our state, over and over and over again, seek to give citizens the rights and the ability to protect themselves, their privacy, and that right in its many different forms, however they choose to exercise it, I think has to always be protected at this point. And for that reason, without being able to articulate a clearer position, makes me uncomfortable with trying to take away the rights of citizens in the face of intimidation and their ability to freely and find some comfort to stand up to an overwhelming force that is trying to control them or limit their free speech and their ability to assemble. So I'm sorry I don't have a better answer for you, but I just felt like I needed to at least say something, but I won't support the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Holland. And I'm going to also maintain my objection, but I really do appreciate where this amendment is coming from intent-wise, because as I mentioned at our most recent hearing, I think it's reasonable for protesters to not wear masks in the same vein. But I think you have a different position and a different power dynamic. I've got a nameplate right here. As an elected representative, I put myself in this position when I filed to run and got elected. Somebody sitting out in the audience is not in that position. They didn't put themselves in that position. So while I would prefer that protesters or those that are assembling not wear masks, I do think it's a different role. But I want to speak very highly also of our peace officers and the challenges it presents to them when you have potentially a large group of masked individuals. And it does present a difficult dynamic. And I really appreciate kind of the intent of where this is coming from to level that playing field. I don't see additional comments, so I'm going to turn to wrap up Representative St. Clair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Some good points were brought up. We're peaceably assemble, protest. I don't think the Constitution says protest. I think it says peaceably assemble. And then you have to define what peaceable is, which actually it's defined several different places. The intent on this was equity. And what I'm seeing or hearing is that, and I agree, we are in official positions. We work in an official capacity. I'm responsible for the words I use, whereas someone in the audience may not be held to a higher standard. I understand that. But my colleague to the right of me said is true. There are questions of constitutionality of this. And with that, I will withdraw this amendment.
Okay. So amendment number 2, also known as I.9, has been withdrawn. And that will bring us to amendment number 3, Representative St. Clair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am not going to offer amendment number 3. It was not crafted in the manner that I was looking for.
Okay. Thank you, Representative St. Clair. Amendment number 3 has been withdrawn, and that will bring us to amendment number 4, also known as I.11. Representative St. Clair.
Madam Chair, I move amendment number 4.
I.11.
I'm going to object for discussion. Representative St. Clair.
I'm not sure after looking at your amendment if your amendment covers this. But what this amendment does is it excludes a peace officer that is assigned to a multi-jurisdictional task force or QRF quick reaction force. And that kind of falls under what your amendment did. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and withdraw this one because I think it's repetitive.
Okay. So amendment number 4 has been withdrawn. Thank you, Representative St. Clair. I was probably going to end up coming down in the same place with this amendment, but I appreciate your effort to put it together. And so that will bring us to amendment number 5, Representative St. Clair.
I'm not going to offer amendment number 5 because, again, it's dilatory with the amendment number 1.
Okay. And so amendment number 5, also known as I.12, is not being offered. And that will bring us to amendment number 6, Representative Vance.
I move amendment number 6, I.8.
Thank you. And I'm going to object, Representative Vance.
This amendment removes establishing the crime of wearing a mask while acting as a peace officer and inserts requiring the Alaska Police Standards Council to establish standards for the acceptable use of masks by a person employed as a municipal correctional probation or parole officer. And what this does is it puts the responsibility of this issue into the local department's hands. And it says that, hey, we want you to implement a standard, a policy on this, rather than us taking this matter into our own hands. And I did ask for a legal memo of some constitutional concerns that I had around this bill overall. And if you don't mind if I refer to some of these things, Madam Chairman. And what my question was is the applicability of the term peace officer and whether that term broadly raises any constitutional issues. So the legal memo says this bill may therefore raise supremacy clause and separation of powers issues. When speaking to the sponsor of the bill, she said that she wanted to cover federal officers, tribal officers, you know, municipal officers, everyone who is a peace officer that is in the state of Alaska. And I recognize that we don't have authority over every peace officer in the state, and wanted to get a distinct indication of what that is. So, the legal memo says that it's unlikely that HB 250 would apply to tribal law enforcement officer. So tribal law enforcement is very specific, and their authority comes from the federal government. And therefore, it would not fall under our state jurisdiction. The Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution prohibits a state legislature from enacting legislation that preempts federal law. There's a lot here, and I should ask my staff to distribute this. The United States Supreme Court has previously held that under the Supremacy Clause, state laws that conflict with federal law are without effect. Our Alaska Supreme Court has also noted that under the Supremacy Clause of the Federal Constitution, state laws that interfere with federal laws are invalid. So the legal memo says, I don't know whether HB 250 explicitly invalidates executive or administrative orders. If challenged in a court that found HB 250 conflicted with executive or administrative orders or directly regulated the conduct of federal officials, it would violate the Supremacy Clause of the United States. And then it also is a separation of powers issue. It may violate the separation of powers doctrine. Although the legislature has the ability to create offenses, it is generally limited by separation of powers doctrine and its ability to direct the executive branch to require specific police officer action, create law enforcement policy, which I think this is what it falls under, or how to exercise prosecutorial discretion with respect to that law. And it does reference a similar state law mask ban enacted in California in September of 2025. And on February 9th, 2026, the U.S. District Court for the Central District of California ruled in favor of the federal motion for a preliminary injunction preventing enforcement of the mask ban against federal law enforcement officers. So that is probably the most up-to-date information that we could have on a similar bill. And so that's why my amendment says, okay, this is a concern about wearing masks. However, I feel that it is improper, it is unconstitutional for us to be making a crime against peace officers for wearing a mask when the responsibility should fall under the Police Standards Council that says you need to push this to your departments to create a policy. Right now, we've heard from them they do not have one in this area, and this would simply put it into the authority that does have the jurisdiction to make these decisions. So I ask for your support on amendment number six. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Vance. I'm going to first ask that you send that legal memo to our office so we can make sure it's uploaded. I think that's a pretty important document for this bill. And then I'm going to turn to Representative Hannon for comment.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. I oppose this amendment, and I'll start in reverse with Representative Vance's remarks. So the California case on February 9th ruled that the California law would not stand because, and the judge, quoting her, the law would be lawful if it applied to all levels, but the California law as crafted only applied to federal officers. Our bill is crafted to address all. The separation of powers and supremacy clause is not settled law. In some states, the idea of if you have a standard, it upholds. So that is why this bill is crafted to address all levels of law enforcement in Alaska. The issue of the Police Standards Council having a standard is commendable and a good step, but that only applies to Alaska Police Standards Council licensed law officers, not federal agents. And we know across Alaska, and of course, ICE has been held as the exemplar, but we have far more and far more common federal law enforcement officers in the state for federal lands that have law enforcement capabilities. So this law, Bill 250 as crafted, is to apply to all law enforcement in Alaska equally. And we believe, based on that California ruling, it would be upheld because it is treating them all the same.
I'm going to go around the table, and you will have a chance for a wrap-up, Representative Vance. I think Representative St. Clair?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I like this amendment. I agree with it, Police Standards Council. And I know the other day we were talking about uniforms and name tags and stuff like that. That's not set by the Alaska Police Standards Council. That's set by the department. So if we're going to look for uniformity and conformity across all boards, we need to look to one place, that one place being the Alaska Police Standards Council. And yes, that California case was aimed directly at the federal individuals, but I still have an issue with the supremacy clause, and I told I'm going to tell a little story here. It's real quick. I know someone who has a federal concealed carry permit. They can conceal carry in California where it's prohibited by law. How is this different? Federal law supersedes. If the officers are even in their policy when they're in tactical gear, and that was one of the ones I was going to talk about, your amendment, in a tactical environment or emergent or planned, most of these things are planned. And if you have a gathering that gets out of control and it's declared unlawful, then they're already there. But what I'm getting at is supremacy clause, I think, is a big deal here, and Rep. Vance alluded to that, and I could not get a memo from legal
because it was so questionable. They said, we have to do research, and they've been doing it for 2 weeks now. So I support this amendment. And I believe that it should be put under Alaska Police Standards Council. And I think it should not apply to federals, supremacy clause, for example, that the person I know that has a federal concealed carry, I support this amendment. I'm getting tongue-tied.
Thank you, Representative St. Clair. I'm quite torn. I'm ultimately, I think, going to not vote for this amendment. But what I personally would like to see happen is, should this legislation, not progress forward, after this committee process, or should this legislation come back before the legislature in subsequent years, I do think that this is a potential, very valid compromise for what the sponsor is stated as trying to accomplish, applying to all law enforcement officers operating in Alaska and not having action on this issue. So personally, I appreciate that this legislation and the sponsor's clarification that this legislation applying to all would likely avoid some of the challenges in the California law. And I appreciate that too, because it doesn't appear that we're picking on one group of people. And one thing I would really not want to do is put in place something that is only applicable for Alaska's correctional officers and state troopers, when I think there's a broader concern that's out there. And the Alaska state troopers we have currently are sort of the least of my concern in that. So those are just a few of my personal thoughts on this, but I also really very genuinely appreciate that this could be a very reasonable compromise to what's being proposed in this bill in the future. I think I have Representative Himshute in the queue.
Yeah, thanks. I just wanted to offer a different understanding of one thing that Rep. Vance said, which is the authority for tribal law enforcement is a partnership with federal, not under federal authority. And the distinction there is, as sovereigns, they don't receive authority, but they do have partnership, I think. It's a really tricky area, but I'm learning about that. And so I want to, just put on record that I think that distinction, and I hope I'm right about it, but it's important if I am. So thanks.
And do we have any additional comment, Representative Holland?
Thanks. Just briefly, I am not going to support the amendment because of what we've already discussed here, but I just want to observe that I think what you've put forth here in terms of a call to the Police Standards Council to look at this issue is a good idea. And I hope with their presence and their participation in this discussion that this may continue forward and there will be some good that comes from the discussion and the work that we're doing here. So thank you for bringing the amendment and the call for action forward.
I don't see additional discussion, so I'm going to turn it back to Representative Vance for wrap up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I love having dialogue on issues, even when especially when we disagree, because I think it's valid for when the courts look back at our committee discussions, and because we know these issues develop over time and we build upon that knowledge. And Representative Himshute brought up an issue that I think is important, and that is the tribal sovereignty and their policing powers. And that is developing in our state. We know that we have Metlakatla, that is the only Indian reservation that is its own distinct jurisdiction. It's Indian land. The others, however, are different. But under a pilot program, a federal pilot program, Chicoloon has a police force. And they operate within their tribal lands in that jurisdiction. And it is a partnership. However, they would not have it on their own. And so in light of this piece of legislation, I think that we run into the supremacy clause and the separation of powers issue about telling these tribal governments that on their land and their peace officers that they would have to adhere to this law. So if we think that if we're looking at the tribal governments that way, we also have to look at the federal government that way. And when asked about, I asked how, if this bill would apply to tribal law enforcement, and our legal services said tribal law enforcement is a complex area of law that I'm unable to fully research in this short turnaround time. Very fair response. The last line it said, it is unlikely that HB 250 would apply to a tribal law enforcement officer. And it talks about, you know, the VAWA pilot program and the partnership that's going on. I have also delved into learning more about that authority and where the state fits into this dynamic. But this bill, the spoken will of the sponsor is to encompass every peace officer in the state. I know you'll correct me if I'm wrong on that, but I think that's the intent here. And we have to look at the constitutional issues of where our state jurisdiction falls. And that's why I thought, okay, you know, clearly there is a will to have a policy, to have a response, and a standard. But this bill is not a standard. This bill is a crime bill. And I think we're saying one thing, but the bill is doing another. And so that's why I came up with this compromise, if you will, to say, okay, let's push this down to the authority so that we don't run into the separation of powers doctrine that says we can't tell the executive branch how they're going to create their law enforcement internal policy. We don't, as far as I know, we don't regulate uniforms, things like that. But what's being said is that we should have a standard about masks, a standard, but this bill is a crime bill. And that's a very different type of regulating the use of masks among peace officers. If you all use the term regulation very loosely here, but just trying to get to the heart of what people are saying is the issue, and hope that this amendment is a start to that. Thank you, Madam, you're Madam Speaker today, Madam Chairman.
I've also got called Senator today, so
today.
happy to keep the spot I'm at right now. Thank you, Representative Vance, and I really appreciate your work to kind of look into this specific area a little bit more. And again, just I would ask for that legal memo so we can make sure to upload it for today's hearing, since we've discussed it in some detail. I believe the objection was originally mine, and it is maintained, so I will ask the clerk to please call the roll on Amendment Number 6.
Representative Hemschut?
Pass.
I'm sorry.
Pass.
Thank you. Representative Holland?
No.
Representative Vance?
Yes.
Representative McCabe, not present. Representative St. Clair?
Yes.
Representative Story?
No.
Representative Hemschut?
No.
Chair Carrick?
No.
2 yea, 4 nay.
With a vote of 2 yeas and 4 nays, Amendment Number 6, also known as I.8, has not been adopted. This brings us, with no further amendments before the committee, back to the underlying House Bill 250 as amended. Is there final discussion on the legislation at this time? Representative Hemschut.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. Through the chair, I would like to know from the sponsor where tribal law enforcement fits in this bill, if you could speak to that.
Madam Chair, clearly I need to learn more and do not have an answer to those questions. The bill does have this next committee of referrals judiciary, and we'll make sure that we look more into tribal law enforcement before that.
Thank you.
And likewise, I think that's a really good area of inquiry. And I appreciate Legislature Hull's response that it's too complicated to get into a short turnaround memo.
You'd like me to have it.
Yeah.
As through the chair, as the bill sponsor, perhaps you had already investigated it and it just hadn't come up. So I wanted to know for sure. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Himshute. And additional discussion?
Madam Chairman.
Representative Vance.
I think, you know, my apologies for not getting the legal memo distributed to everyone. I was trying to decide, you know, it was a very fair assessment about the tribal, the law, you know, and she included a full paragraph in there, and my staff has gotten the legal memo to Stuart to distribute to members. And I think that the response was, hey, it'll take more time because this is an evolving issue around tribal law enforcement and the pilot programs that are occurring with the federal government right now. The state is still looking at what is our relationship to those programs. And a couple of years ago, I spoke with the chief of the Chickaloon Police Department, I think. Steve may know if that's the full title, about the pilot project and how that was going to take effect and how that was going to impact state residents when they were on tribal lands, because there's a lot of concerns and understanding all of that. So I do give a lot of respect to the information that the legal memo has provided, and feel that it was very fair in updating on kind of what the most obvious questions should be. But that is our responsibility to delve into those questions in committee and parse them out, because as the sponsor said, some of those questions are not answered. But I think in Alaska, because we have 229 federally recognized tribes, not all of them have policing power, but some are in the process of having some sort of authority. And we have a lot of Alaskan residents who are concerned about that because it's new. And this particular bill could have a direct impact on that in our relationship with the tribes, in that law enforcement and the understanding, and also with our federal partners. So I do sit on Judiciary Committee, and I will be taking a further dive into this. But I think my homework in between now and then is to look into the tribal law more and see if maybe we can get some answers before the next committee, in all fairness. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Representative St. Clair?
Through the chair, I've made it abundantly clear I don't like this bill, and it is what it is. I'm not going to stop it. It goes through a process. I hope that judiciary does their due diligence to get the information on the supremacy, because that's kind of up in the air at the moment, and that's a new twist with the tribal. There's too many unknowns with this. And with that, thank you.
Thank you. And I don't see any additional comment. I guess the final thing that I would add to this legislation is I do think there's quite a bit more questions to take into consideration here. This is the first committee and the first body of referral. And as we discussed on Tuesday, it's not always my intent in this committee to produce the absolute most polished. Every avenue of every item has been thoroughly discussed. I hope to hear a bill, if it's in its very first committee of referral, take into consideration some of the potentially glaring challenges. And we addressed a couple of the considerations that came up through discussion and an amendment today. And I do agree, though, that there are significant potential considerations here. And I really appreciate where the amendments today were coming from in terms of trying to potentially provide additional clarity and or exemption where it's appropriate. So I do hope that the Judiciary Committee takes this up and looks into, in particular, some of the issues you brought up today, Representative Vance. And I also do want to see this legislation move forward because I do think there's a huge concern in a lot of our communities about the precedence that's taking place in a lot of other places and what it could mean for Alaska. And this legislation is maybe one of the few preemptive things I've seen in our legislature in a while that's trying to proactively work on preventing a problem before it begins. And so I do kind of want to see this move forward today, but I really appreciate the discussion and considerations here. With that said, and not seeing additional comment from members, I'm going to ask for a motion.
I move that the House State Affairs Committee pass House Bill 250, also known as 34-LS1284/I, as amended, with individual recommendations, attached fiscal notes, and authorizing legal services to make any necessary technical and conforming changes.
Object. And there is an objection. Representative Vance, would you like to add to or speak to your objection?
I think we've covered everything.
Okay. And with that objection maintained, I assume, we can go ahead and have the clerk call the roll on House Bill 250.
Representative Story.
Yes.
Representative Himshute.
Pass.
Representative Holland.
Yes.
Representative Vance.
No.
Representative McCabe, not present. Representative St. Clair.
No.
Representative Himshute.
Yes.
Chair Carrick.
Yes.
4 yea, 2 nay.
The vote of 4 yeas and 2 nays, House Bill 250 has moved from the House State Affairs Committee as amended, and that is 34-LS1284/I. We will take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork and get set up for our next presentation. Thank you, Representative Hannon and staff, for participating with us. At ease. House State Affairs is back on the record, and the next item on our agenda today is House Bill 152 from Representative Galvin, establishing an education head tax. This is our fifth hearing on the bill. Today we will have continued conversation from where we left off at the last meeting, and we have Representative Galvin and her staff, David Jang, here with us at the table. We'll have some continued discussion today if there's further questions on the legislation. And then my intention will be after that to set the bill aside. I do want to remind committee members up front that we have an existing and extended amendment deadline that is set for this coming Monday, March 9th at noon on this legislation. So it's our intention to have this bill come back up next week. If you struggle to get amendments in that time frame, again, please feel free to reach out to our office and let us know as soon as possible. But for now, I'd like to ask Representative Galvin to put herself back on the record and if you have any opening comments for us.
Sure. Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss this bill. We've already discussed it, I think, 4 times, so I don't want to dig into too many details. So I'm going to give you just a 1-minute overview. The state is in trouble. We have a very large fiscal gap that we know is structural. It's been in place for quite some time. Historically, oil and gas filled roughly, the revenue from oil and gas was at 90% at one time, and now it is filling our budget by about 30-some percent. And my staff may correct me on some of these numbers because I'm estimating the amount of funds that are filling our budget for next year. This is our operating and capital from our earnings of the permanent fund is roughly in the 40%. And then, of course, we get some federal funds. And after that, there's a very tiny percentage coming from mining, the times that we pay to use parks and things like that. So what I'm getting at is that we need to have broad-based revenue in our state. It would be wonderful if all of a sudden we could diversify our economy and we could make money from selling widgets and other things so that we could still maintain our roads, our schools, our healthcare needs, all of the things that we know are keeping us whole here in Alaska. To some degree, our local municipalities and government is taking care and filling in some of the important government services, but the state also has responsibilities. And certainly in the world of education, we have a big responsibility to fill. And so this bill is helping us fill that gap. And the bill is a broad-based income tax along with a head tax, a little bit of both. The head tax is $150 as written per year for only for wage earners in the state. And then in addition to that, for those of us Alaskans who make over $150,000 per year, we're going to tax only the dollars above $150. I want to make sure that's clear to everybody. So if you made $151,000, then your tax bill would be the $150 head tax plus the 4% of the $1,000 or $40. So you would owe $190. That would be what your tax bill would be if you earned $151,000. So that's what I just want to give you that example. If you earned as a household 300 or more, let's say it's 301, then each wage earner would have to put in $150 each. And the family household taken from your federal fund, if you made a 301 for joint filers, the plan is that your total household would be, if it's two filers, $300 plus the $40. So I'm just trying to help us understand what we're talking about in terms of taking money off the table that somebody's using for their groceries. Additionally, importantly, it captures those who are earning funds, and especially the high wage earners who come in from out of state who are already paying taxes in the lower 48. They are not getting double taxed, but they are going to have to put in the same amount that Alaskans are putting in, which is 4% above their 150. And it closes the S corporation loophole. So those who are organized in that way, if they are a single owner of a business and they're organized in that way, and they make more than $150,000, that same 4% applies. So that's what the bill is in summary. And I know that we've discussed this a bit, but I don't know. I think sometimes it helps to hear the recap to kind of picture yourself in it, understand how it might look for you to and your constituents, more importantly, to receive this bill or news of this bill, which sometimes is shocking because Alaska has not had a broad-based revenue tax bill like this. And so I appreciate that and happy to have these conversations.
Thank you, Representative Galvin, and thank you for your previous presentations as well. I did want to note for committee members, we received a response from the sponsor's office to some of the questions asked at the previous hearing, including the number of S corporations currently in Alaska, a state-by-state comparison for Western states in particular of some income tax rates and looks like standard deduction brackets, and then our historical head tax or historical income tax information. Head tax, income tax?
Head tax.
Either way. So that information is also available for members. Do we have discussion or questions on House Bill 152 for the sponsor? Representative St. Clair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. and I'm always the first one. Through the chair, Representative Galvin, how much do we know how much this is supposed to generate in a year?
Thank you, Representative St. Clair. I'm going to ask my staffer to answer what the latest fiscal note says, although I think we've mentioned before, we're not sure that they've, we know that they were using old data. I'm going to just put it at that, but I'm going to say that if anything, it would have increased from whatever we've heard from the last fiscal note. Representative Chang or David Chang?
Everybody's getting an upgrade.
I'm upping it.
I will say, Senator? I think speaker was maybe the best
chair.
Upgrade.
To Representative Sinclair, it's that's a good question. The most recent fiscal note received from the Department of Revenue estimates between 300 to 350 million in revenue that would be generated from this bill. This would include both the head tax as well as the 4%, though the bulk of this figure comes from the 4% on the earnings over $150,000 for single filers or $300,000 for joint filers.
Follow up? Thank you. Just as I looked, I found it just as you were talking about it. Question number two, that's in totality. Do we have, I'm going to look before I ask, why are we calling this an education tax?
Thank you. Through the chair, of Representative St. Clair, I think we've discussed this at our very last meeting. Both you, Representative McCabe and you asked this question, and I answered that the intent is for these funds to go toward our public education system.
One more.
One more follow-up.
With that being said, I do recall that conversation. I apologize for being duplicative, but I'm probably going to make the same statement I made back then. It can't be a dedicated fund. It's another pot of money that can be reached into.
Thank you. Through the chair, if I may answer that. I appreciate your concern around that. And I will add that historically, we have not seen that folks who have listed intents meant that it was a whole big giant pot of money that people are going to put their hands in. I think that I can understand that concern. And in this case, we are so short our funds right now that we're looking at $500+ million of a dip into our CBR account, our savings account, that's earning roughly 3% as opposed to if it were in a protected any of our big funds right now, like the HIFE fund, is currently earning 7%. And so I appreciate your concern, and I just want us to be mindful that sometimes it's helpful for folks to understand why we have a bill in place, especially like this. And I thought that the language of education tax would help people understand the reason that I'm having the nerve, the courage, or the crazy head to come forward with the tax is that I know we've got a problem, and gosh darn it, we haven't had another solution yet to fix it. We should have by now, but we haven't. And so here I am.
Thank you, Representative Galvin. Just as a quick aside, we heard last year in this committee, just one hearing, but we heard a bill from my office that would have established a royalty dividend program to change the dividend formula. Mm-hmm. And I did crunch some numbers myself. And if the legislature were to today pass the bill that I have and this bill before us in their current form with no changes, we would not have a deficit next year. We would have a surplus next year. So just, I wanted to point out that this legislation, from my perspective, is making a substantive dent in the overall problem, in our structural deficit. And it does take courage to bring something like this forward for consideration. So just to add to what you were saying.
If I may comment, Madam Chair, I also want to add that you all have control of this now. I've given you what was a suggestion, and I've explained the knobs that could be turned. And one of the biggest knobs is that $150,000. There still is not that floor, which, you know, some people think, oh, geez, why did you set it so high? Well, that if that knob moved to $100,000, I don't know if David, my staff has numbers on this, but we know that it would mean a substantial change in dollars to the overall fiscal impact. And so I just wanted to share that piece with you because you're trying to figure out how to make very big, important decisions around bringing in revenue. And that might be one lever that you could pull, but that's a policy decision that is tricky. And I do have, if it would please the chair, I can give you a little bit on the numbers on that if you would like.
Yes, Representative Galvin, I'm going to consider this a follow-up to my statement, and then I'm going to go to Representative Holland. But do you have the numbers for what the per household tax looks like if the number was set at $100,000?
Through the chair, for the record, this is David Jang, legislative staff to Representative Elise Galvin. I don't have the numbers specifically for if we lower the standard deduction to $100,000, though I can. I do have a model that, and if you're looking for that specific answer, I can get back to you. I will refer to slide 21 from a previous presentation on this bill from April 24th, 2025. This slide also appears in the presentation from the last hearing. If we lowered the standard deduction to $75,000, the estimated revenue according to this model would increase from what it is currently, $300 to $350 million. Lowering it to a standard deduction of $75,000 would raise it to over $600 million.
And just as a quick follow-up, that's at
$75,000. At $75,000 standard deduction.
And this is Elise Galvin, and for the record, that's from data before PICA, before Willow, before a lot of the project have come into play. So this was from our older presentation. So I want to make sure that you're aware of that as well. Though we do believe that $100,000, it would be a really strong impact.
We'll go to Representative Holland and then Vance.
Great. Thank you. Through the chair. First off, on the issue of the idea that this has some relationship to education, I think it's really valuable for us to look at, and I'm interested in looking at some of potentially intent language, and some of the language is probably already in there. Because to the degree that we help Alaskans get better educated and get better jobs and make more money, and they're paying some income taxes that helps fund the education system, we're erasing some of the Alaska disconnect. And I think that's a really profound, necessary part of an economic policy, that our investments lead to a stronger economy, and our stronger economy allows us to have better public systems. So connecting income and income tax and education together is creating a positive, virtuous cycle that is more people make more money. And we want people to have successful, rich careers and great jobs in Alaska. And we want more of the high-paying jobs in Alaska to go to Alaskans. We're creating that reinforcing positive dynamic that allows us to have a better education system, which means we have better employees that make more money. And yes, they pay a little more potentially income taxes, but that means the education system gets even better. And so we do even more. So I like that area. And I'd like to look at, the intent and the clarity that we're trying to show that we're cutting down some of the Alaska disconnect that has hobbled us in so many areas. I'm also interested in two other areas. I'm looking for any comments that you might want to offer in either of those areas, but also just to let the committee know what I'm interested in working on here in terms of amendments potentially to this. One is, and you'll see in the memo that we sent out, we've been looking at the question that's been proposed through a couple of different op-eds and ICER work that has asked the question of, is there a way for us to eliminate some of the federal taxes? And you'll see in this memo that we've shared and in the answer in the memo from Galvin's office to the chair, that there's a little bit of room to work in there to the degree that the permanent fund dividend is potentially tied to offsetting some of the tax. We might be able to help people not have to pay income taxes on that dividend money. But there's also some places where I was looking and interested in a broader use, kind of a digital wallet. Could we pay for DMV registrations, business licenses, fees, permits, everything else? And there we kind of cross into a line where the fact that you're making a decision on how to spend your money means you now have domicile and now it becomes taxable. So I'm going to be looking at potentially, you know, some language around how do we take advantage of this ability to keep a little bit more of the dividend revenue in the state versus going to federal taxes. So that's another area I'm working on. And again, if you have any comments, the final one I'll just kind of throw out there is I'm also looking at the question of the stair stepping. I'm coming at it from the position that Alaskans of any income level are probably already kind of maxed out. The cost of living, the disruption, the uncertainty around how much it costs us to pay for our homes, our cars, or everything else. And so I'm cautious about any sort of discussion about taxes because few people have any extra money. They're doing something with it, whether it's paying for education for their kids, putting in savings, or just simply trying to get by. So I'm interested in potentially looking at how do we phase this in, and would invite any feedback or comments. And what I've been pondering is, would it make sense in the first year to turn on the head tax? And in the following year, perhaps turn on some or all of the income tax, perhaps tied to how much the permanent fund dividend is, so that there's a little way to protect folks who are thinking that this is going to disrupt their budgets in a way that they can see a little bit of an on-ramp to the change that's being made here. So I would invite any, you know, feedback from the bill sponsor on those ideas if you have some thoughts, and just let others of you on the committee know that if you're interested in working in any of those areas, or maybe already are, that, you know, we can potentially collaborate on that. But I just want to give you a heads up on that. So again, if there's any comments through the chair from the bill sponsor, I would welcome that feedback.
If it would please the chair, my staff is going to have one comment with regard to the first question-ish that you presented, and then I have a couple of other thoughts. Go ahead and preach.
Go ahead.
Through the chair to Representative Holland, this is David Jang, legislative staff to Rep. Elise Galvin. Just wanted to add some additional context to the memo that was released by Legislative Legal regarding the wallet structure. According to the constructive receipt doctrine, the federal government treats income as taxable when it's under taxpayer control. So the distinction is if the head tax, or I'd say the 4% flat tax, were automatically applied to whatever the tax amount is, without any choices to pay DMV fees, hunting fishing license fees, that the amount that is going towards state taxes wouldn't be taxed federally. However, the remaining balance as it is in current day would be taxed federally, that remaining balance. So say if you had a $1,000 PFD, if you had a paying that $150 head tax, $150 is not going to be taxed additionally on the federal level, but the rest of that would be $850 would go on the federal, be taxed federally. If that option were to be expanded to include hunting and fishing license fees, DMV fees, then that whole amount would go under federal taxes. Just want to make a distinction that this, like under state statute, it's there's no state taxes that are levied on the PFD. It's just federal.
Thank you.
Thank you. And through the chair, Representative Holland, you commented around perhaps that multi-levels or stair-stepping in might be helpful. And the other thing that you mentioned was beginning with the head tax, just to maybe keep it simple or one thing at a time. And I, of course, will support whatever this committee decides. But I will add that if we're talking about those who perhaps cannot add an extra thing to their budget, probably the head tax will have more impact negatively on more vulnerable families because it will be applied to all wage earners. And it's their first paycheck, $150 off, typically is the way states have done a head tax. And we've done it that way. It's been done through Department of Labor and Revenue work together, and it's pretty simple for most. And the other comment I would have in thinking about that is that the amount of funds that come in from the head tax is so far lower as opposed to the higher earner tax. So just want to make sure you're aware of that too, because if you're looking to fill a hole, it depends, but you're not going to gain much beyond the costs of the tax division's work if you are just only applying a head tax. And the last comment I will make is that there is some validity to your point of a taxpayer in actually, this is a worldwide study. In general, those communities who pay a tax in general are more likely to be more engaged in period. They actually have higher voting turnouts, for example. So there is something to be said for that. I appreciate your comment to that. I also appreciate that I would be held more accountable. What are you doing with my dollars? Right now, what we're hearing, sometimes we do hear, what are you doing with my tax dollars? But then we remind them, other than the pass-through that we get sometimes from the federal government, which many people do pay their federal taxes, it doesn't really apply. But people are concerned about what are you doing with my PFD dollars, for example. And anyhow, I just do appreciate that sense of ownership of the public services that they expect due to whatever it is that they're paying into. So thank you.
We have time for just a couple more questions today. Representative Vance, and I also put myself in the queue.
Thank you. I have several questions. I'm looking at the fiscal note from the Department of Revenue, and it shows they said they can't anticipate what the revenue can be. However, on the cost, they would said that they would need 70 full-time positions, and the amount is pretty consistent until FY 2030, and it jumps dramatically, and then it goes back down to the amount of the other years. So I find that curious, and I would hope that the bill sponsor would kind of get an answer to push back on that. But my question to you, and I apologize if I asked it last time, I've been having conversations with my staff about this, so I can't quite remember if I did ask it in committee, is have you done projections based upon the upcoming projects on the North Slope and the LNG? Because we're estimated to have 7,000 to 10,000 workers in the next few years. If your bill were to pass into law, we know that it would take at least 2 years for regulation and implementation, and that's acting quickly, to capture all of these workers. And with that, in the question of what a projection and estimate could be of this tax coming in, is looking at what the average salary would be for those positions. With that, you would also need to include what the projections in the seafood industry are. There have been many changes. That has been one of the lead industries that have out-of-state workers in the summertime for their processing plants, but there's been many changes, and so I think that we are likely to continue to see a decrease in that. So while we may have an increase in one industry, we're having a decrease in another leading industry, and I'm curious as to what those changes are. That will have a direct impact on this, and I was wondering if your office had been looking into the projections and getting us more concrete numbers, because I feel like we're absolutely lost if we're using numbers from several years ago.
Thank you, through the chair. If I may answer a couple of those questions, I'm assuming we're good to go ahead and
answer. I'm so sorry, Representative Galvin. Yes, we have a kind of we say through the chair in this committee, but we're a little bit, we're a little bit more informal on the dialogue back and forth.
I want to be respectful. Thank you. So to answer your question about the fiscal note and the costs out your costs, I agree with you. There were some questions, and I would hope that we would hear from DOR at some point, because that was an uncertainty. With regard to the fisheries versus incoming projects, potentially, especially at 7,000 to 10,000 workers in oil and gas industry. We were told oil and gas industry in general is averaging 175,000 per year. In fisheries, it's a little different because the season is much shorter. So I'm not sure how often it gets to beyond those numbers. In fact, we did not, what I was told is that's very, very rare because the season's so young, short. In addition, hospitality, a lot of those different seasonal work pieces are difficult to know whether it's going to be a big year or not. COVID certainly changed a lot of different industries, but that's what I have with that. And my staff also has one more bit of detailed information to report.
Through the chair to Representative Vance, this is David Jang, staff to Rep. Galvin. I would point members to item in their packet, which is the Non-Residents Working in Alaska report published by the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And there it has helpful data on the percent non-resident, which in oil and gas, on average, it's about 40.5% non-resident. And that number gets higher if it's like positions such as service unit operators, operating engineers, which are more around 47.8%. That being said, we don't know what future projections hold in terms of that balance between non-resident and resident, but this gives us an idea. And it also provides the average non-resident versus resident quarterly wage. And if you, oil and gas, this is on page 9. If you look on page 12, this is for seafood processing. This you will see that it's more like 81%, 82% non-resident. But if you look at that quarterly wage of workers in the seafood processing industry, quarterly wage non-resident being 10,821, resident being 13,336. So you multiply that by four, that's only, 50 to 55,000 a year. And that would not hit that 4% for the 150,000 standard deduction. They would only be taxed the $150 head tax. Now, if you go back to oil and gas, that's average non-resident quarterly wage is $35,233 and resident quarterly wage is $40,143. And if you do the math, that's around $150,000, $160,000. So that would hit that 4% with the $150,000 standard deduction.
I had put myself in the queue as well. One of the things that's happened with our state's budget, especially regarding education, but as other municipal costs as well, is the state's functionally, by not having some way to capture statewide revenue, has functionally shifted costs to local municipalities. And I can speak for Fairbanks. We had an effort by community members to increase property taxes temporarily to help fund education so we wouldn't close 7 schools a couple years ago, and we wouldn't take some of the other actions we did take. But other municipalities have successfully raised their local tax, either property or sales tax, where applicable. And I note that the chart you provided in response to my inquiry last time about what other states are doing, generally it just says, the chart just says plus local tax rate. So it lists like a sales tax rate where applicable and then has plus local sales tax. And it's a long question, but I guess what I'm getting at is we don't have a statewide sales tax. So it's hard to calculate an overall tax burden on Alaskans, especially in those communities where there's a higher sales tax or high property tax rates compared to others. And so one thing I think would be really interesting to get a comment on or to see is what is the tax burden look like locally around the state? And I know that those resources are out there too. But say in Bethel, where they have a 10% sales tax across the board, what would the overall tax burden look like for the average family? Maybe use a family of 4 as the typical, but trying to compare what someone making $152,000 in Bethel is paying overall in their tax burden versus somebody in Fairbanks or Anchorage, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I think that would be really interesting. And I don't know if you have a comment there.
I do have a brief comment. And so this is also in consideration of, right, we're adding sales plus maybe it's 150 plus whatever percent, 4% or whatever we choose of their overall wage. We did consider sales tax. And the reason that sales tax wasn't very popular in finance this year, for example, and AML, so all of the small communities, over 105 of them, are in a municipal league that is an association of sorts. And they weighed in because they understand that we do need to get some sort of a broad-based tax. So they are supportive of a broad-based tax. They'd like us to be thoughtful about that and include them in the discussions. And they had an interesting presentation that I'd be happy to take some of that information and then put it into maybe example A, B, and C for you of different taxpayers around Alaska. I think that would be a great fun project that I know my staff would be all over doing. But also just, I think it's important to state in general, AML said we would prefer an income tax. That's right. What they said. They would prefer that. They've seen this. They were here the last time, last year when I had a tax that was similar. They weighed in on it. I didn't ask them yet this year again, but yes, that has been a consideration. And we also modeled for you in one of the earlier pieces what it was like for income versus state in general, income versus a sales tax in general. But if we wanted to couple them both together and show you examples, that could be something else we could do. So you could see the overall yearly output from families. I think that would be a good project. And I have one more comment from
your comment next.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm going to jump back in here, Rep. Mm-hmm. Galvin, because I think I just want to clarify what that project might look like for your staff. Maybe for just a couple of specific communities. Bethel, I know, has a very high sales tax rate. So I'd kind of like to see Bethel, and if you need to change the communities, I understand. But Bethel, say Kenai, Wasilla, Fairbanks, Juneau, Anchorage. Just to give a sense, because, mm-hmm. And what I'm looking for here, as your staff is able to complete this, I totally understand. It's a large ask. I'm looking for the overall average tax burden for that family, not so much what they're paying in sales tax and what they would pay in income tax with this legislation, but what's the average actual tax burden for a family in Bethel mm-hmm. with the current sales tax rate, and how would their overall income be impacted by adding this additional statewide tax burden? And the other thing I was going to ask you is, do you know of any examples? I can't think of any, so I'm just genuinely curious. Do you know of any examples where a state has offset, has created some kind of graduated state income tax wherein it only takes effect after a certain cap has been reached? In other words, if someone has extremely high local tax rates, if you are in Bethel and you have that 10% sales tax rate, is there a situation that you know of where maybe people in those communities don't pay tax? And what I'm getting at here is less the overall tax burden for these folks. It's more this broader question of when people pay taxes, who would they rather pay to? And I think one of the challenges in our community in Fairbanks, when we had a ballot initiative relating to increasing property tax for the specific purpose of education, one of the pushbacks was, well, that's the state's job. We don't want to pay higher property taxes because we believe the state should be taking care of that issue. And so I'm more looking towards this idea of at what point do we have an income tax take effect if local taxes are higher? Or is it better for this institution of a new income tax to maybe incentivize municipalities to jump in with the continuing model we have right now where we're passing off these burdens? So
I thank you. I think I understand where you're headed. And first of all, we can't conflate local taxes with federal taxes. I don't think we could max say, oh, hey, since the local tax is so high, the income tax burden then should be less for these individuals. The way state taxes work, there's all sorts of tax laws that are quite complicated. I really wanted to figure out a way to not tax Alaskans so much and make sure that those who were already paying their taxes in Idaho or wherever else could, that we could capture that if they were earning their revenue here. And I could not, there's just all kinds of laws that say, you know, a broad-based tax is a broad-based tax. And remember, it is unique because these local governments have already been scaling to where they're fitting their local needs. And so that's why it was so complicated to add on top of that, because some have, you know, Anchorage has no sales tax and Ketchikan is a giant one. So it would be really complicated to please everyone in that way. And it would interfere with their jurisdiction. And, you know, we were really trying to do what we could do with the tools that the state could have. It is complicated. And by the way, I'm talking about a state constitutionally mandated system that has to be in place when I talk about education. We need to pay that bill. We need to pay the bill for taking care of our roads that are state roads. We need to take care of, you know, there's a lot of things that the state has to take care of that local. And sometimes we work together and partner to take care of things together. But there is this difficult hole in our budget that I'm trying to fill, and it has to be done with a broad base. And by the way, the other really big plus that I want to share with you, Chair Carrick, is that I've heard in several places that since Alaska does not have a broad base tax, and because of the volatility of our oil revenue, and actually the volatility of having so much of our money tied to the stock market, we have some volatility, even though we have so much money in our permanent fund corpus. So it's very, it would be helpful for those who are doing ratings, the Moody's and others. We have a lot of different variations of loans, and our ratings would only improve if we were to have this lever in place, which we don't have, which is a broad-based tax.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And I would look forward to seeing maybe a little bit more comparison now in Alaska. We have two more questions, and then we're going to wrap it up. Our Vice Chair Story, and then Representative Hemshue.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for the comments. Some of what you were just talking about now had to do with my question, and I certainly want to comment that certainly $150, I can, in Juneau, that is, I can buy more with that $150 than I can in Skagway and Haines, which is the other couple of the other communities. So that point is well taken. I also am thinking, you know, we've been wanting to have a fiscal plan, been talking about the importance of a fiscal plan, because what is it costing us not to have one? And I think that's what we were just talking about now. When we look at, you know, not being able to provide certain state services. And so it has a cost for employers deciding whether to come into the state or not. And I think that's one of the things we're going to have to be weighing as legislators. How much is it costing us, excuse me, in our economy? How much is it, are we, is it setting us back? And we've been getting the feeling and the results that it has been setting us back, not having a fiscal plan. So I appreciate you bringing this forward. My question that I was coming to is, most of the people that I talk to, they're all about wanting to do a plan if non-resident workers can, you know, pay a tax. And can you please remind me, I know you have said it before, why can we not just have non-resident workers pay a tax?
The federal government will not allow it. I wish.
Beautiful
but
answer.
But to your comment about the savings, should we be more fiscally prepared, responsible, et cetera? Every industry would be able to attract workers more if we were to be a stable economy that had a quality, well-funded education system. There's no doubt in my mind. We've heard from another representative who has another bill in place regarding recruitment and retention. And in that presentation around that bill, it has been really eye-opening for me to see that, for example, we're paying $127 million in trainings plus in recruiting to get enough public employees alone. That's not even talking about industry, which I know they would love to have more of their workers who are local families. They've asked for it. It's really a place where, to your point about, let's also make sure that Alaskans can get the higher wage jobs. It's all interrelated. And, you know, little things like bond ratings you think isn't important, but we have millions and millions of dollars where we're paying a certain percentage of our interest to that based on our rating. So all of these things tie in together. And that is why we've had a fiscal working group years ago. They've come out with some good examples of what we could do. Certainly, we need to tighten our belt, which we have done. You can show that in all of the longitudinal studies around. If you know, compare it for inflation, we've tightened our belt, and now we need to also make sure that we have enough funds to deliver to families what keeps them here, and that's really important point. So thank you.
Okay. We're gonna have to wrap the conversation up. So I'm gonna go to Representative Hemshue and then Vance, but I really want to get to the last bill on our calendar today. So I'm just gonna ask everybody to keep their comments concise, as our Madam Rules Chair would tell us if she were here. Representative Hemshue.
Please don't time me. Okay. Through the chair. I really just wanted to make a couple of comments. Like, I think it is really, in a way, an act of courage to bring a bill like this. So thank you for that. And whether it goes anywhere or not, you're pushing a conversation that we need to have. I just wanted to put on record, 13 of my 21 communities tax themselves. So anytime we talk about a sales tax, those communities who are taxing themselves in my district, I get a little wound up, because the state services that folks in the urban parts of the state enjoy are generally not available in those communities. So now to take that whatever percent tax they already pay to sustain themselves and add a bit for the state on top for services they don't get, is going to be a really hard battle for my vote to make that happen. So I'm just putting it out there for the world. But I, at the same time, I'm willing to talk. Like, we need to do something. So I appreciate that what you're talking about here is an income tax. You know, is it an either or? Is it both? Is it, you know, a flat fee like you're talking about, the $150? But I just thought I would toss out there, and I'm sure our legal team will love me for this, but let's do a 25% summer sales tax and then a rebate in the winter. Put that rebate on the dividend. Let's try that one out. Anyway, just putting out there that we all recognize how difficult it is to live in this state, make ends meet, but having so many systems in meltdown is not working either. So we're already, I think, struggling with cost of living. But then when state services also aren't able to deliver, we need to give families a reason to stay. So I appreciate the bill, and I'm sorry to go on a bit of a tangent there. Thanks for bringing this.
And I don't know if I heard a question there, so nope. we might move forward. Thank you, Representative Hemshoot. Representative Vance.
Thank you. I say to Rep Hemshoot, preach, because Homer and Soldovia have some of the highest tax burdens in the state. And my community feels very similar, that it does not receive a lot of the state services that other urban areas do, even though we're on the road, Homer's on the road system. But I've been running some analysis, and I want to put this out there as a piece, since we have an extended deadline on what we need to consider around this bill. And the questions have gotten that have been raised in committee. So comparing Alaska with the U.S. average, the total state and local tax burden is about 5% of income in Alaska, about 11% of the U.S. average. Property tax rate is 1.1 to 1.2% in Alaska. It's 0.9 on the U.S. average. We have no state income tax or sales tax. The national average for income tax is 4 and 6%. The sales tax national average is 5 to 7%. However, this is where Alaska faces the challenge, is about 25 to 30% higher cost of living. So what that means is that when you factor in all of that together, a typical U.S. state, the total effective spending is $111,000 equivalent. In Alaska, it's about 125% equivalent. So according to this analysis, Alaska feels a 15 to 20% more expensive overall for the same lifestyle, depending on location. And the factors is because our utilities are 57% higher than the national average. Food is 27% higher. Transportation is 17% higher. And then healthcare is among the highest in the U.S. So obviously, this is just a quick AI analysis to throw out there as me asking some general questions that we've raised in committee that especially by the chair, that we need to factor in. We're still behind the eight ball as far as our cost of living goes, and a tax of any form is going to be a burden, no matter what. And as we turn the dials, we have to do a cost analysis. What's the return on investment? What is the cost benefit, you know, ratio here? And I will be very forthright that I was elected on the premise of no statewide income tax, because my predecessor was hell-bent on not only reducing the dividend greatly, but also income tax, which is the same place that we're at right now. And so I'm going to keep my word to my district, but I am open to finding solutions and how that can look for us, because that is my responsibility. But I wanted to just put it out there to the committee to look at those numbers. I used AI because they can do math a lot quicker than I can. And try the different versions of AI out there. Also, it looks like the representative has a brilliant staffer who can crunch numbers for us, which I greatly appreciate all the work that our staff does. But you know, to echo Representative Hemshoot, we do have communities that are taxing to pay for for the local contribution on whether that is a city or the borough to help pay for those services. And that is a significant concern. And I think it's our responsibility to get that information. I was disappointed that ICER did not have a local analysis of what a sales tax would look like. That was very disappointing because we're Alaskans. We have Alaska-specific questions. So we maybe should be the ones to do that work and get that information on the record so that it can be a working document. So thank you for letting me expound and just throw out some numbers out there. I encourage you to do the same because I think that's going to help us determine what the policy should look like.
Representative Pimshue.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. I just want to point out something we use in my hometown a lot is the quality of life is something you cannot find anywhere else in this nation. And so that I love that thing that you found that said it feels like we're 15 to 20% more expensive than their places overall. So far, mostly in my hometown of Sitka, people feel like that's still worth it. But if that goes a whole lot higher, you know, because there's the intangible part of getting to be in this state that I think most of us cherish. And if that comes at a cost premium, there's a certain amount of that. But we've actually negotiated teaching contracts where we accept less than inflation for an increase, which is going backwards, because we're also thankful to get to teach in that district. So that premium that we're willing to try to afford has a breaking point, and I think we're pushing up on that quickly. So thanks for the Google, your AI search. I think that was fabulous. Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate that too, Rep. Vance. I would just add, you know, our just going back to what I had said at the beginning about if you combined this royalty dividend bill I have and this bill, you close the budget deficit. But I just want to acknowledge what you said, because we close the budget deficit we currently have. That doesn't necessarily mean communities can lower their tax burden in order to, because they're getting more support from the state on services. And it doesn't mean that we're actually investing in some of the things that we also know could save money down the road that are of a higher cost up front. So there's a whole lot more to discuss, but I really appreciate the discussion about the impact on different communities, because that's important. Representative Galvin, final word, and then we have to move on. So,
thank you. And I really appreciate the conversation. Thank you for the honor of being able to be a part of that. I will encourage folks to look in their tab. I believe it's tab 7. The Fiscal Working Group has done some work on this deep dive on a lot of these tough decisions and looking at impacts. And I think it's valuable. It's also valuable to look at what Homer and Soldovia will be looking at for them in their own wage salary. I think it'd be important to look at that community, how they would be impacted in those ways. At the same time, helping them to see that some of their services are state services they don't even know they have. Whether it's getting roads built that help to bring the workers in the different times, or the ferry system, or whether it's Medicaid costs that the state has, because now we're having a higher cost to help supplement the federal changes that have been made, or maybe it's some of the major maintenance that we know our entire state needs right now, and that will save us money down the road. But we've got so many schools that need roofs that would really benefit from making sure that our system was whole, that we have a real budget that we know we can live within our means, but also keeps us living the lifestyles that we want and we choose to live. We've had the largest out-migration of teachers. So while we still have our elders tending to stay here, the demographics show us that we do have some issues within the working aged Alaskans. And a lot of us are staying. I'm staying. But there are those who truly have chosen a different pathway due to how we as policymakers have been avoiding some of these tough decisions. And so I'm glad that we're here at the table talking about them now, and then and maybe we'll come up with some solutions that are very different from taxing. But if we don't come up with something, we're going to see the spiral continue, and the spiral is heading downward. That's all I have.
Thank you, Representative Galvin. Really appreciate it. I do want members to start working on their amendments, or continue to if you have not. We intend to take this legislation up next Thursday for amendments. The current amendment deadline is Monday, this coming Monday. I'll just say on the record, it's fairly likely I'm going to extend that amendment deadline again, considering that we're taking the bill up on Thursday instead of Tuesday next week. But we do intend to work on this next week and potentially take action in the committee. So I just want to thank Representative Galvin for being here and staff. And we're going to take a very brief at ease. Oh, we're not going to take a brief at ease. we are at this time going to jump right into the final item on our agenda. I was waiting for my staff to give me an indication of whether we needed to take a break. The last item on our agenda today is House Bill 278 from Representative Costello, the Alaska-Ireland Trade Commission bill. This is our second hearing on the bill, and today we do have a committee substitute to adopt that has been put together in consultation with the bill sponsor's office. And my intention with the very limited time we have today is to bring this committee substitute forward, see if there's any quick discussion, but set an amendment deadline today on this bill. So with that, I'm going to just note that we also have Hannah Lager from DCCED online. And I believe we still have, nope, we do not anymore, have Senate President Mark Daly in Ireland, and it's about 2 a.m. there, so I'm not surprised. I'll look to Vice Chair Story for a motion on the committee substitute.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the House State Affairs Committee adopt CS for House Bill 278, also known as 34-LS1299-T, as our working document.
Thank you, Vice Chair Story. And I'll object to ask our committee aide to walk through the committee substitute changes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Stuart Relay, staff to Representative Carrick. There are various changes in Section 1 to the commission that is established in House Bill 278. The changes in subsection A are conforming. The changes in subsection B increases the length of term, the term lengths for commission members from 2 to 3 years. The changes in subsection F relate to the authority of the department to accept donations. We kind of reworked that with the sponsor's office. And specifically, this section specifies that the department may accept a grant, donation, or gift from a public or private source for per diem and travel expenses and other assistance needed by the commission. There is a new subsection gamma G, that specifies that members of the commission are voluntary, they serve without compensation, and are not entitled to per diem or travel expenses unless that they receive a grant to receive those. There's also a new subsection H, that changes reporting requirements. In the original version of the bill, the report that was included was a one-time report. This CS changes that to a yearly report, and it also adds disclosure requirements for the contributors, for the people that for the donors that give grants. That is the same information that all of you are required to disclose on your APOC reports. That's the same type of information required in this in the reports. There's another new subsection I, that specifies the commission may not contract for services or support to prepare its annual report unless someone makes a donation for that purpose. And the new subsection J is also a conforming change. Again, as I previously mentioned, the former section 2 of the original version of the bill was the report. That has been removed because we take care of that as a yearly operation of the commission. And so that language has been removed from Section 2. There is now transitional language relating to board member appointments and staggering term lengths. And Section 3 is unchanged and immediate effective date. That, Madam Chair, are the summary of changes. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. It looks like we have a couple questions. I'm also going to ask Hannah Lager to come up for an initial question here. And while she's walking up, I'll go ahead and ask the question. With this committee substitute changes, does the Department of Commerce anticipate a fiscal note or a new fiscal note? What is the impact to the fiscal impact of this legislation? I guess I'll put it that way.
Yes. To the chair, I would need to examine it a little bit more and to produce the fiscal note. I do expect that with the change to travel, that the travel portion and the reporting portion of the fiscal note would be impacted, but it's possible there could be other impacts. So we just need a little bit more time with the substitute.
Okay, thank you. Sorry to put you on the spot there early on. Representative Holland.
Great, thank you. That was my question.
Okay.
We're all set.
Are there further questions on the committee substitute? I will just say I think it was both our office's intent as well as the sponsor's intent to reduce the costs very significantly, if not entirely, to the department with this legislation. And I might ask Representative Costello to come forward and offer further comment on the committee substitute.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Representative Costello, and I want to say I really appreciate your office working with my office on this committee substitute, and you're correct. We're hoping there's no impact to the state and that the work is done and any costs are incurred. They're paid for through the donations.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Are there additional questions on the committee substitute? Seeing none, I'm going to remove my objection. And seeing no further objection, the committee substitute for House Bill 278, version T, is adopted as our working document. Are there additional discussions from the committee members about this legislation? Seeing and hearing none, I am going to set an amendment deadline for House Bill 278 of Monday, March 9th at 5 p.m., that'll be this coming Monday at 5. Again, as with all other bills, if members have any trouble working with the sponsor's office or working with Ledge Legal to get amendments back in time, please let us know as soon as possible. And with nothing else on our agenda today, we're setting House Bill 278 aside, and our next meeting is this Tuesday, March 10th. I wanted to note for committee members, we had initially planned next week to have a meeting on Saturday. We're no longer planning to have a meeting next Saturday. We are planning to still have a Saturday meeting in March, though. It will be likely the last weekend in March. So we'll communicate with members about that upcoming. So our next hearing is this coming Tuesday, March 10th, and at that hearing, we will take up for a first hearing House Bill 221, Establishing an Arts and Culture Day, from Representative Hall. House Bill 278, the legislation we've just heard from Representative Costello. House Bill 295 on PFD eligibility for pilots, from Representative McCabe. And a first hearing on House Bill 189 on PFD conviction records, from Representative Mears. With nothing else before the committee, we are adjourned at 5:08 p.m.